Yeah. Thanks a lot, Greg. It's a real pleasure to have the opportunity to speak to this community. When we sat down with Lars last week and he said, we'd like to have a Blackboard talk, there's interest among other current KITB participants in what this Superbugs program is. Richard Nair, who's in the back and one of the two co-organizers, and I took that very seriously. And we're really delighted to have the interest and to have all of you come out. So as Greg said, I'm not a physicist, and I'm going to speak primarily about the biology of drug resistance. I'll make some contact with a little bit of quantitative theoretical thinking, but I think primarily the novelty that I can share with you has to do with some really interesting biology. Interesting and in some cases, deeply troubling biology. Let's see, what else did I want to say in the way of introduction? So the program that started last week will run for 9 weeks. It runs concurrently with an experimental summer school entitled Microbial Strategies and Evolution, and there's really strong overlap in interests and expertise between the instructors in that program and our participants, and the students in that program are coming to many of our lectures, and many of the program participants are very excited to look over the shoulders of the students and see what's going on in their coursework, so it's really a very rich opportunity for all of us. Of course, the study of evolution and population genetics is not new to KITP. I came here for the first time 3.5 years ago for Viral 11, which was the third or maybe even fourth program that took population genetics as its jumping off point. And what's new with the program that Richard and Ville Mustonen, who will be here in 3 weeks, and I have put together, along with obviously a lot of help from Boris and Greg and other folks here, is the inclusion of folks who are not sort of the usual suspects, as we put it colloquially among the three of us. You know who you are. Instead, we're trying to draw also experimentalists who work on particular drug resistance systems, epidemiologists are a strong component of our program, and even clinicians who have frontline experience with an expertise in some of these systems. Speaking for myself, as Greg said, I got interested in evolution by natural selection as a computer scientist when I was exposed to the world of genetic algorithms, what's now called evolutionary computation, and I gravitated first toward microbes and then toward drug resistance evolution, to be honest, because that's where the evolution is. I think of Willie Sutton who robbed banks because that's where the money is. And we're really learning a lot about the clinical problems, but also we're learning a lot about fundamental processes in evolution by natural selection by the study of drug resistance. Last week, Bruce Levin, who unfortunately already left, made the point that for him at least, getting involved in drug resistance was also a good career move. And he said he doesn't fly coach ever anymore. Now that he's working on drug resistance, he's living the high life. So maybe we ought to take Willie Sutton a little more literally and acknowledge that in part the reason we study drug resistance is perhaps because that's where the money is. So I'm going to sort of talk to the problem that we all hear about in Time magazine and on television about the possibility of a return to a pre-antibiotic era, a sort of a medical dark ages, put that prospect into a little bit of context, talk a little bit about the history of infectious disease, and then talk in some detail also about evolution of cancer. So I should say that our program is divided into four sub-intervals. We're going to spend 2 weeks or so working on bacterial drug resistance, and that's more or less starting today after having gotten the course started a week ago. We'll then move on to the evolution of drug resistance in viruses, a lot of work there, of course, in HIV, and I'm sure we'll also hear a lot about influenza. We'll spend 2 weeks on malarial drug resistance, really pressing on the scale of world public health, a really pressing problem. And then the last 2 weeks in the middle of September will be devoted to the evolution of drug resistance in cancer, which is, of course, not an infectious disease, but it is a deeply evolutionary system. And so this afternoon, I'll say a few words about that as well. Okay, so that's sort of the outline. I'm going to say a few words in general terms, but not rigorously quantitatively, about the way we think about how evolution works. And then I'll introduce you to a fair amount of biology around infectious disease, and then about cancer. And then toward the end, I'll sort of knit things together and talk about some of the recent advances and some of the opportunities that at least I personally see in the field. And so I should acknowledge this is going to be a pretty idiosyncratic presentation. And of course, informal, I've never spoken at KITP for 5 minutes without having questions from the floor, so don't be shy even. Just put your sandwich down for a minute. So the first thing I want to talk about is just sort of the basic facts of evolution and the most basic fact of evolution that we have to stress to our undergraduates, but which an audience of physicists knows perfectly well, is the fact that it's not individual organisms who evolve or which evolve, it's populations. So here's a population at some time, and here are a bunch of individuals. And I was born with a genetic composition that I was born with, and that's the end of the story as far as I'm concerned. But over the course of generations, so we might imagine some mutation appears in this individual, which is beneficial in that environment. And I'll say a few words about what we mean by beneficial. I mean, what we mean technically is that the number of offspring is on average increased in organisms that have that mutation. But as we'll see, and not surprisingly, there's a considerable stochastic component in the process as well. So this is at time t, and here's the population at time t plus 1. And what we expect in the probabilistic sense of the word expectation is that the number of individuals carrying the mutation will go up. That's the definition of an increase in fitness, but it is an expectation, and there's stochasticity. Particularly true, and then obviously as you iterate the process, after a few more generations, we might expect every individual in the population to be carrying this beneficial mutation. Stochasticity, though, enters immediately because the process of reproduction in natural populations is a crapshoot. Not everybody gets to reproduce, no matter how good their genes are. Sometimes you're walking down the street in Manhattan and a safe falls out of a window and kills you, and it doesn't matter what your genetic composition is. That beneficial mutation that you were carrying is lost. The prospects for stochastic loss of beneficial mutations, of course, is dependent on the number of copies of these beneficial mutations in the population at any time. So when the population is, when the mutation is rare, the stochastic effect is strong. Once there are a large number, an appreciable number of copies of the beneficial mutation in the population, the probability of all of them falling into manholes or having safes fall on their head is much reduced. So what we typically see in terms of the dynamics of this process, if this is time and this is the frequency of a beneficial mutation, we start at something very low. We often will designate the population size with capital N. So we might imagine a mutation appears first at frequency 1 over N. And this is now a beneficial mutation, so it has some opportunity to increase in frequency because it increases the reproductive output on average. But it doesn't do so deterministically at the outset, so it wiggles around in frequency space down here. It may be lost. In fact, for most beneficial mutations, the chance of loss is better than the chance of survival. So there'll be a sort of a dance here. The mutation maybe appears 2 or 3 times. And then finally, it enters a deterministic regime where it follows a classic logistic form. And so these are sort of the dynamics that describe the way a beneficial mutation appears. So to be a little bit quantitative, we can write down the population size you've already seen as N. We'll call the mutation rate mu. That'll be the per position, per nucleotide mutation rate, per reproductive event, per site, per generation. We'll designate the size. So let's imagine now I'm a pathogen, I'm in the environment, I'm in the patient's sick, the patient goes to the doctor prescribes penicillin. Imagine that there are, and this is probably not true, but imagine that there are 10 sites in the genome into which a mutation will improve the survival in the presence of the drug. So that will designate by L size of the mutational target. Beneficial. Okay, so N times mu is the per population mutation rate. per site, and L is the number of sites that matter. So the product of these three things tells us the probability or the rate at which beneficial mutations are introduced in the population. And then we need something, which I'll just call P, which is the probability of, I'll use the word fixation, perhaps slightly technical population genetic lingo. What we mean is frequency of 100%. And so this somehow captures the stochasticity in the process. So the product of these things tells us the probability that a beneficial mutation will survive the gauntlet and reach fixation. Okay? Now, this is true if mutation rate is very low. If mutation rate is large, things get much more complicated, because before this mutation fixes, some second, let's take advantage of the lovely colored chalk, some second mutation will appear. And maybe it competes with the first mutation. It's better than the first mutation. It's not as good as the first mutation. I haven't told you whether it appeared on the background, that is to say, in an organism already carrying the first mutation, or if it appeared on what's called the wild type, the ancestral type. So when the when the mutation rate goes up, the dynamics become a lot more complicated. And they're sometimes represented schematically by what's called a Muller plot. Herman Muller was the pointing out that X-rays cause mutation, and he drew these first pictures for the first time. This is still frequency. This is still time. But what Muller plots show are these increases of one type, which maybe then begins to compete with this type. In the middle of this, some other type appears. You see these sort of overlapping exponential expansions that are all competing with each other. The dynamics of this process are obviously a lot more complicated, and they depend on all sorts of things like the distribution of these I didn't apologize, I wasn't rigorous here. This is the selection coefficient in parlance. Efficient, which is the proportional increase in reproductive output. So the shapes of those things depend on the distribution of those selection coefficients. This is a really hard problem. In fact, substantial progress was made beginning about 10 years ago by names that are familiar to this community. Daniel Fisher, working with Michael Desai, when Michael was a graduate student at Harvard, also with Andrew, who's here, Rita's contributed to the problem, and several others have helped us to understand kind of quantitatively what this thing looks like. But I'm not going to belabor the point, because it's not my area of expertise, and it's not really central to the process. To the overview that I want to give. All right, anything else to be said on this topic? I don't think so. I'm going to slide the board up and start to talk about microbiology, if everyone's content with that.
I have a question.
Yes, please.
Somehow you're normalizing, like,
this picture assumes the population size is constant. That's a fair point, and that's a serious consideration in the real world, not so serious in my community because we're mostly just allowed to make up anything we want. But it's a fair point that, for example, if you're the bacterium in the patient who's presented at the doctor with an infection, the doctor prescribes penicillin and these beneficial mutations don't happen, well, if the drug works, that population goes extinct. So there's a parallel body of theory that accommodates changing population size. The dynamics, I don't think, are really dramatically that different. But that's a fair point. Thank you. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So you have all these graphs to describe the dynamics.
Yeah.
Do you have any equations to describe?
Yes. That? Yes. Of course. But as I say, I'd rather talk about biology today. Yeah, but this is not just a cartoon story. This algebra is well understood. Yep. I'm sorry, I was a little bit. Yes. Yes, thank you. So the way to interpret this is the vertex is the appearance of a beneficial mutation, which then, by definition, begins to expand in the population. And the distance between the two lines is the frequency of that mutation in the population. There's a lot of freedom in how I draw it. But for example, before this mutation, let me change the game in the middle here. Imagine another beneficial mutation. So there's no particular significance to where on the y-axis the beneficial mutation appears. It's just an individual. And from there, it begins to expand. So here comes a second beneficial mutation, which expands. And so the way I've drawn this then, and I apologize, I should have worked more slowly. Let's disregard these later curves. But this beneficial mutation here, I claim, has higher reproductive success than does the first one, or indeed this second mutation, which appeared, I'm imagining, on the background of that first mutation. Well, as I say, the total distance between them is increasing exponentially, because that's what populations do. They grow exponentially. One could as well draw it like this. I mean, that's the way I drew it there, with an exponential increase. But the second mutation is, at least by convention in these figures, drawn somewhere in that field. I don't think there's a great semantic import to that choice. Yeah. I haven't given it as much thought.
Maybe it would be helpful to also show that sometimes the thing can reduce the size of the.
Yes. Right. So that's what I began to do here. Here is a first beneficial mutation, just to have some name. We'll call this A. Here's the second mutation, B. And again, I apologize for having drawn this rather quickly and not sort of walked you through what was going on. But let's imagine that this B mutation is increasing at the expense of the A type, which is here. So not everybody increases. In fact, nobody increases forever, because the subsequent beneficial mutations will appear that are expected to displace the first one. OK, the next part of the talk, actually, if there aren't any more questions, I took from an introduction to microbiology that Don Anderson gave us last week in the auditorium. And so I apologize to him. He's not here, fortunately for me. But it just sort of to introduce you to some of the quantities that are at play in the world of microbiology. The fact is that most organisms on Earth are invisible. And by most, I mean the vast majority. So there are biologists divide the world of organisms into three classes, two of which are invisible to us: bacteria, which are then themselves divided into bacteria and archaea. Bacteria are what you think they are. Archaea are a second. That must be EAE. Are a second class of single-celled organisms that were only described when DNA sequencing came along, and people noticed that there were these highly diverged single-celled organisms are typically so-called extremophiles. So these are the ones that you find in hot springs and in highly saline conditions. These are together about 10 to the 31st organisms. So this includes E. coli and lots of bacteria that make us sick, and lots of bacteria that are critical. In fact, these organisms in general are quite important for lots of biogeochemical cycling processes. Viruses, of which there are order of 10 to the 32nd organisms. This is to say individuals. Viruses, much to the amusement of my kids when they learned this in high school, are not classically designated as being alive in high school textbooks. This really tickled their funny bone, because I studied viruses and viral evolution at the time, and so they sort of wondered what kind of biologist I am. Viruses are considered not to be alive because they don't do any metabolism of their own. So viruses all are characterized by a life cycle in which they attach to a host cell, infect the host cell, either by the entirety of the virus being drawn into the host cell, or at least the genome being drawn into the host cell, and then they pervert the host cell's own metabolic apparatus to synthesize their progeny. Finally, are the eukaryotes, which are the organisms we know and love. All plants, all animals, all fungi are in the eukaryotes. These organisms are characterized by a lack of subcellular organization. Subcellular organization. They don't have mitochondria, they don't have chloroplasts, they don't have Golgi apparatus, they don't have nuclei. It's a bag of metabolism, of chemistry, the DNA of which, in which is also just sort of free-floating. In contrast, eukaryotes are defined by the presence of subcellular subdivision. So we have nuclei, we have mitochondria. If we're plants, we have chloroplasts, we have Golgi apparatus, we have all the other apparatus that's visible in the microscope that allows for some more complex metabolism. Yes? Yes, so these are not my numbers, but people, these are mostly in the ocean. And so people will take a liter of seawater and look in the microscope and see what they see for bacteria. Interestingly, and then extrapolate. Interestingly, there's something that's called the paradox of the plankton that's been known for many years. The number of bacteria you see in the microscope in seawater is two or three orders of magnitude greater than the number of bacteria you can grow in the laboratory. So we just don't have the right culture conditions for most bacteria, possibly because they live in sort of consortia together. That's one possibility. Or we just don't have the right carbon sources. And the number of eukaryotes, well, I couldn't find an estimate for the number of eukaryotic organisms, but people estimate there may be on the order of 10 to the 8th species. So if you want to guesstimate how many individual organisms there are in a species, you can guess as big a number as you want, but you're going to be many log orders below that, the numbers of bacteria and of viruses. I'm sorry? Oh, God, no. No. I said, oh, God, no. No. And to be honest, I don't even off the top of my head, I don't know where this estimate comes from, because viruses have the problem of culturing, right? So we need to know what bacteria they grow on to easily be able to count them, although they can be seen in the... They can be done. That's true. You can do it by... Yes, I was going to say, possibly see it in the microscope. But Eric points out you can also take seawater and just take DNA out of it and sequence it in bulk and see what the menagerie of sequences are that you see. And this is also used to get a sense of the magnitude of these numbers. Okay? So even though eukaryotes are a vastly smaller number of organisms, they probably account for about half the total biomass on the planet, although most of the eukaryotic biomass is tied up in plants. But it's rather sobering, I think, at least for me, to think that half the biomass are in these organisms that we can't even see. These facts notwithstanding, most of these organisms don't make us sick. So roughly, out of all of these, roughly 20 species, let's see, of bacteria and viruses, and so the malarial parasite is itself a eukaryote. Roughly 20 species are responsible for about 80%, is that right, of U.S. infectious disease. Mortality. So most of these microbes just go about their business and we don't know about them and they don't know about us.
So is that because they haven't come in contact with humans?
Or? No, I don't think so. Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, I don't know a great deal more than you do, but I don't think it's for that reason. I think it's just because most bacteria make a living by some scheme that doesn't involve taking advantage of something about our metabolism. Yeah. So Don showed a plot last week, which I saw before, that's really interesting. I want to talk now a little bit about the epidemiology, about how infectious diseases are transmitted and how they've been controlled. So this is a plot in which this is time, starting at the turn of the last century and running to today. And this is a mortality. Look down. Mortality in units of per 100,000 individuals. This is U.S. mortality due to infectious disease. In 1900, the number was about 800 800 individuals per 100,000 died of infectious disease each year in 1900. And this line drops roughly linearly to about 50 by about 1950. There's a spike here. That's 1918 flu. And then it was flat. And then in about 1985, it started to go up. This is not to scale. This is the beginning of the HIV/AIDS pandemic. This is in the US. And this is roughly coincident with the introduction of pill, which was the first mass deployed antibiotic. That's right.
So how much of that is public health and how much of that is true non-antibiotic?
I don't know. The point of I've also had to do primarily with better water. But you're absolutely right. There are non-antibiotic medical interventions, like quarantine, that may have been deployed as well. It's a good question. But the point is that in the U.S., this 16-fold drop in mortality essentially predated the deployment of antibiotics. So a great deal of progress can be made without any antibiotics. On the other hand, I'm not going to tell you that we can live without antibiotics. Antibiotics have tremendous importance, it goes without saying today. They're tremendously important in parts of the world outside the developed world where public health measures are lagging. They're tremendously important. This is a thing I hadn't appreciated until last week. They're tremendously important for a bunch of medical procedures that implicitly are predicated on the availability of good antibiotics, like surgery and burn therapy and chemotherapy, all of which are obviously augmented with strong regimens of antibiotics. And so the loss of antibiotics to drug resistance evolution would have serious implications for those sorts of procedures. And we have a bunch of current day infectious disease in the U.S. that the death rate of which from which is small enough not to show up on this graph, but which are of serious medical concern, like multi-drug resistant TB and HIV/AIDS, and of course MRSA, methicillin resistant Staph aureus, which gets a lot of attention. It's actually been, I think it's been 10 years or so since MRSA became the leading cause of infectious disease death in the U.S. It displaced HIV/AIDS about 10 years ago. MRSA? I don't know the answer. It's certainly associated with hospitals, but you read a lot of papers about community-acquired MRSA as well. Yeah, so I think the answer is probably less and less as time goes by. Yeah. Okay. So I want to say a few words about how antibiotics work. Antibiotics work by targeting aspects of the metabolism of bacteria. I'm thinking now about antibiotics that target bacteria, work by targeting aspects of the bacterial metabolism that's distinct from the human. So for example, bacterial cell wall synthesis is completely different from ours, and that's where penicillin works. The bacterial ribosome, which is the cellular apparatus that does the translation from messenger RNA into protein, is quite different in bacteria. I mean, we all have them, but they're sufficiently different in bacteria that drugs can be developed against those these sorts of targets. And so then the natural question is, how does drug resistance work? Well, drug resistance works by a few mechanisms. Sometimes there are enzymes. In the case of penicillin, there's commonly an enzyme, this is actually the system we've done a lot of work in, an enzyme that degrades the drug. So the drug is enters the cell by diffusion and then it becomes inert inside the cell. There are so-called efflux pumps, which are what they sound like, pumps that actively export toxins from inside the cell and protect the cell. There are also opportunities for this drug's target to evolve. So methicillin is a drug that also targets cell wall synthesis. It's not the drug that I work on, but it also targets cell wall synthesis. But there, the resistance is not as a consequence of a drug that degrades, of an enzyme that degrades the drug, but rather it's the consequence of the drug's target becoming slippery and able to, so the drug's target is itself an enzyme. The enzyme binds a substrate and does some chemistry, and the drug binds in place of the native substrate, incapacitating the enzyme. Methicillin-resistant bacteria have a variant of this enzyme which can discriminate between its native target and the drug, and thereby are no longer sensitive to the drug. Now, we might wonder where resistance evolves, there are two answers to this. First of all, you should be aware of the fact that, I'm sure you all are, that there's a great deal of antibiotic deployment that happens in agricultural settings. Far more antibiotics, 80 or 90% of all the antibiotics that are deployed in this country are deployed in agricultural settings. And a lot of the antibiotics that we use have long half-lives. So something like half the antibiotics that are deployed both clinically and in agricultural settings enter the environment in the urine of the animals that have been dosed and encounter bacteria in the environment who then experience these selective pressures. The statistics are roughly one-third of antibiotics are deployed to humans and two-thirds are deployed in agricultural settings. And importantly, these are not deployed primarily in response to sort of clinically acute circumstances by veterinarians, but rather because it's been shown that the antibiotics increase the growth rate of the animals. So I'm a farmer who's growing cows, and I've discovered that if I feed them a low-level dose of antibiotics, they grow more quickly, presumably because it knocks down their microbial load, but it's not in response to any sort of clinical need. So that's one component of the way that drug resistance can evolve, and that kind of pressure that's introduced by the deployment, particularly of long-lived drugs, is going to do something along the lines of these. These are going to be then de novo mutations. That's what's happening here. This red line represents a red beneficial mutation that appears over and over and over again. Another really important component of the origin of drug resistance, though, comes from horizontal genetic transfer. So bacteria are remarkably able to share DNA between contemporaries. This is something that we don't do, right? We share our DNA with our children, and we got them from our parents. But bacteria can share DNA with contemporaries through horizontal genetic transfer. There are a number of mechanisms by which this is accomplished, and the details of which aren't terribly important for our purposes, but I do know a couple studies that are truly sobering in this regard. So in one study, the group took DNA I mentioned earlier in response to Eric's comment, that you can take DNA from anywhere. It doesn't have to come from an organism. You can take it from seawater. This group took DNA from human fecal samples and took the DNA, and rather than sequencing it, they transferred the DNA into test bacteria that test E. coli cells. And then they asked, which of those bacterial cells that are now carrying DNA from the feces of humans exhibit antibiotic resistance? So what they're doing is screening for the presence of antibiotic resistance genes in the guts of these humans who probably were healthy, although I don't remember the particulars of the story. So the results of this study, and you know, the absolute numbers aren't that important because they reflect the size of the study, but the results of the study are that they found 95 genetic elements, pieces of DNA that came out of the feces of these humans that confer antibiotic resistance to these bacteria in the laboratory where no resistance was present previously. These 95 bacteria exhibit resistance to 13 mechanistically diverse antibiotics. So I told you some antibiotics target cell walls, some target the ribosome, others target other biochemical functions that all over the map. And most alarmingly, very few of these new, so now that you have these pieces of DNA that confer drug resistance, it's easy to sequence them. And these fragments of DNA that confer drug resistance exhibit very little sequence homology, very little sequence similarity to the genes that we know clinically to confer resistance to these same drugs. So this is a whole nother menagerie of genetic mechanisms that can confer drug resistance. I shouldn't say genetic mechanisms, a whole nother menagerie of genes that confer drug resistance outside of the ones that are being seen in the clinic today. Another study with a similar result took Arctic core samples, ice, 30,000-year-old ice. Let's see, what did they do? Found resistance cassettes, that is to say, genetic pieces of DNA in the bacteria in that ice, that exhibited resistance to all the drugs we love the best, like tetracycline, and in particular, vancomycin, which you may know as one of the sort of most recent last line of defense drugs. Vancomycin's a really interesting case because vancomycin resistance is a complicated biochemical process. It takes 5 genes. And so there's a so-called resistance cassette that's observed clinically that has these 5 genetic elements that together give bacteria resistance to vancomycin. Well, this 30,000-year-old bacterium from the ice had a vancomycin cassette with 5 genes with very strong similarity to the modern resistance cassette. So the point is that in addition to this de novo process, which is presumably being driven and accelerated by use of antibiotics, both clinically and agriculturally, there's also a great reservoir of resistance genes out in the environment. And I haven't gone into the details, but take my word for it, bacteria are really good at sharing DNA. So 2 species, that one of which has resistance and one of which does not, if you grow them together in the presence of the antibiotic, you may find they both have resistance at the end of the day. Okay. On the other hand, I've just talked about bacterial drug resistance evolution. I should note that viral drug resistance probably evolves de novo in patients because viruses can only live in patients. Similarly for malaria, the causative agent for malaria, I told you it's a eukaryote. That's of small consequence for our purposes. It's a little microbe that lives in humans and it lives in mosquitoes and then it comes back to humans. We all know the story of the efficacy of bed nets in sub-Saharan Africa. And so the resistance to drugs in these organisms, as well as in cancer, which I'll get to in a few minutes, surely evolves de novo in every, if not in every patient, at least within humans. You can imagine the transmission of resistant infectious agents, but that resistance in these cases will have arisen in the host. Okay? Antiviral drugs, I talked to you about antibacterial drugs that target the biology that's unique to bacteria. Antiviral drugs, of course, target the biology that's unique to viruses. It's in some ways easier to imagine antiviral drugs because the biology, what you need is a target that's distinct from any biology going on in the host to reduce toxicity. That's not, that you can imagine, this is not my business and obviously it's not easy, but you can imagine that there are opportunities to develop drugs that target the biology of viruses, which have low toxicity because that biology doesn't exist anywhere in the human repertoire. On the other hand, viruses are themselves so distinct from each other that the prospect of sort of broad-spectrum antivirals, we have broad-spectrum antibacterials, the prospect of broad-spectrum antivirals are very limited, so that we tend to need drugs that are distinct for every virus. One exception to this are drugs that stimulate the host immune system. This is what interferon does. It stimulates the host immune system. That works against infections of lots of viruses. Okay. I want to talk a little bit, before I start to talk about cancer, I want to talk about sort of not quite abiological, but larger social components that influence drug resistance evolution. We already talked about the agricultural use and that there are strong economic pressures to maintain that practice. So agricultural use of antibiotics is outlawed by the EU almost 10 years ago, following the lead of Sweden and Denmark 10 years before that. But in the US, the FDA sometimes, in the last 2 months, I read some story about the FDA saying, yeah, we're interested in that, and then the story drops away. And that's presumably because the financial interests are so entrenched on the agricultural side that this is a really a tough nut to crack. But that's not the only sort of aclinical component of the story that you can imagine. Another important component is that antibiotics are expensive to develop. Every drug is expensive to develop. It costs, I've been told, something like $10 billion for a pharmaceutical to build a new drug, and order of 10 years of time. And antibiotics that work are a crappy business model, because if they work, then you can only prescribe them for 3 weeks, right? It's a better return on investment if you can develop a blood pressure medicine or a cholesterol drug or a mood-enhancing drug. People take those for the rest of their lives. Finally, Susan Fitzpatrick, who was here last week and who will be back for the last 3 weeks, pointed out something that I'd never thought about, and that has to do with sort of the sociology of what goes on when you go to the doctor. So you go to the doctor because you've got a fever. And you know you should be able to tough it out, but it really is kind of lingering. And I had an experience like this shortly before I came here. I'm going out of town for 9 weeks. I want to go see my own doctor. I go to the doctor. Now, if the doctor says to me, listen, it's probably viral, and we don't have antibiotics that work effectively against anonymous viruses like ear infections and strep throat. Not strep throat, but against ear infections, which are often viral. I'm going to feel I was a dope to have taken a half day off work to go find the doctor, and a little bit ripped off. The doctor has similar reciprocal feelings. He feels like he has some obligation to make me feel better by giving me a prescription. And in fact, really interestingly, Susan told me about a study where doctors admitted that writing the prescription was a nice way to signal that the examination was over. Well, if you're not going to write a prescription, the patient might never live. I mean, what we need are prescriptions for sugar pills. The doctor should be able to not tell you that what he's giving you is a placebo, and everybody be happy. But the point being that there are things that are bigger than this, you know, what we used to call PQ population genetics. We can't talk about PQ anymore when there are lots of co-segregating variants, but there's more going on than just this process, okay? Okay, I'm going to shift gears now and talk a little bit about cancer, which is not, of course, not an, in general, not an infectious disease, but does evolve resistance. Let's just start by setting the context. So the U.S. mortality to cancer can be shown, let's find another color, green. Actually, I shouldn't start it here. I couldn't find statistics before 1950, but since 1950 and up to the present, mortality has been about 180 per 100K. Flat. It's gone, prevention and screening reduces the number, but increased longevity increases the number. And so it's more or less not changed, just to kind of give us a sense of the context. The number one killers in the U.S., of course, are strokes and heart attack, heart illness and strokes. And they're two times higher than either of these quantities, if I remember correctly. Cancer is also an evolutionary process. This is something I had not appreciated until maybe a half a dozen years ago. It's not evolution at the level of organisms. So here we have mutations and organisms. But it's evolution at the level of cells within organisms, right? Cancer is an uncontrolled outgrowth of some tissue or of some cell type. And so those cells that are outcompeting the others are doing exactly what I showed there, but they're doing it within a single individual organism. It's unique to multicellular organisms. So multicellular organisms are really an interesting puzzle for evolutionary biologists, because the cells that had the bad luck to become my liver, their DNA has no chance of being propagated into the next generation. It's only the DNA that gets into the gonads that goes forward to the next generation. So somehow there's been a sort of a social contract that was established at the beginning of multicellular organisms. Colleagues of ours study this problem very intensively, both the biology of that origin and also the population genetics of that origin. Multicellular organisms have entered into this social contract, and the liver cells are willing to pull on the oar because the DNA in the gonads is pretty close to their DNA, and the net effect is a much better opportunity for propagation into the next generation than if they were still going it alone as single-celled organisms. And cancer is a breakdown of that social contract. Those cells said, "The hell with you! I know a better way. I'm just going to play this game right now, and I can't even be bothered to worry about the fact that the host in which I'm living," let me say it a little more strongly, it's not that they can't be bothered to worry about the fact, it's that they can't respond to the fact. Evolution is a little bit like the stock market. It's very much driven by short-term returns. So the cell in my liver that wants to start to proliferate uncontrollably has no choice. That is to say, the Darwinian paradigm will run on it, even though in the next 10 years it will cause me to drop dead, and if I'm young, will cause me not to reproduce. So it's a breakdown of the social contract. And this, by the way, I should just acknowledge that this tension in levels of selection is indeed a very rich theoretical area. It comes up all the time. For example, I have a student who works on the evolution of virulence in infectious. It's a theoretical work on the infection of virulence in these kinds of systems. If I'm a pathogen, let's imagine I'm an HIV particle, I've just infected a new patient, what do I want to do? I want to make as many copies as possible. Now, if that causes me to cause my host to drop dead sooner, to stop moving around, then my opportunities for propagation will be limited. But that's a long-term return, and it's very hard for these long and short-term opportunities to be balanced. And that's exactly what goes on in cancer. Interestingly, naturally long-lived organisms don't get cancer a lot more often than do short-lived organisms. So there's some very famous examples. The blue whale is a famous one. We're not a bad example of a fairly long-lived organism. But the cancer rate in these long-lived organisms is not proportionately larger. Excuse me. yes, I have some statistics. Long-lived organisms, according to my notes, may have a million-fold more cell divisions in their lifetime than will short-lived organisms. So if we're waiting for these mutations to appear, you might imagine opportunities would be much greater, because I told you that the probability of adaptation is sort of the product of these things. That this is per generation. We put in 10 to the 6th more generations. Why don't long-lived organisms get cancer 10 million times more often? Well, the answer presumably speaks to the fact that there has been evolution for mechanisms to control the spread of cancer. So as organisms, this is sort of a toy hypothesis. I can't even call it a hypothesis if you can't test it, I suppose. But this is sort of a toy model. Organisms begin to live longer. Cancer is a problem. But if I have a mutation that somehow protects me from the emergence of cancer, for example, some more rigorous enforcement of the social contract, and Greg doesn't have that, then in the long run, on average, I'll leave more offspring than Greg. So we can have the propagation of selection at these very short time scales bearing on longer time scale events. But technically, in my field, we describe that as indirect selection. It's a very real effect, but it takes a while to happen. The fact that long-lived organisms don't get cancer a million times more often than short-lived organisms do suggests that this process has been in effect. Relatedly, my graduate student Chris told me recently that it turns out it's much easier to make immortal cell lines from mice than it is from humans. So immortal cell lines are a regular tool. Mammalian cell lines are a popular tool for clinicians, among others, model systems in which I can grow in a very controlled way cells that are of interest. So I work in bacteria. That's sort of the most complex, E. coli is the most complex organism I work in. Real clinical biologists say, well, you can't really, that's not really where the action is. The action's in mammalian cells. So we grow these mammalian cell lines, which we can immortalize, HeLa being the first such example that's well known. Turns out it's a lot easier to immortalize mouse cell lines. What you do is you just grow them in culture, and once in a while, they won't die of their own accord, right? Cells are programmed to die of their own accord. That's, again, part of the social contract. But mouse cells do it more, are a little bit more lax in the enforcement of that. That's an empirical fact, because you can immortalize these things. Presumably, at least that's consistent with the observation that it's harder to do it in humans, and humans don't get cancer, even though we have a million times as many cell divisions in a lifetime. Okay, this tension, the reason, the observation that long-lived organisms don't get cancer proportionally more often is what's called Peto's paradox. And the resolution of the Peto's paradox seems to be this sort of indirect selection, that mechanisms that protect populations of cells from this liability will, on average, leave more offspring. Okay. The evolutionary nature of cancer explains both why we get cancer and why it's so hard to treat. And the biology within a tumor is really complicated, because tumor cells are really heterogeneous. So we can do single-celled sequencing. I'll say a few words about that in a few minutes. But single-celled sequencing reveals that the constellation of mutations that are present in cells in the same tumor is very variable. So it's very hard to understand what's going on inside a tumor. That's sort of part of why we've convened our group. Drug and drug failure, of course, is well known, unfortunately. How do drugs work? Well, in the case of bacteria and in viruses, we target biology of the pathogen that's distinct from our own biology. In the case of cancer, that's not actually terribly easy to do. But cancer cells are characterized by very rapid growth. So we look for things that target cell division, things that interfere with mitosis, for example. Taxol is an example of that. Interferes with the formation of the microtubules that are responsible for pulling apart the chromosomes at cell division. Unfortunately, we also have healthy cells that are that are undergoing mitosis, and this is why patients in chemotherapy lose their hair and they have digestive troubles, because the epithelium in their stomach is being, or in their intestines, is being degraded by this process as well. And resistance in cancer works roughly the same way as it does in other organisms we've already seen, so the target may be modified or the cell may get better at pumping out the toxin or something like that. Yeah. Rapidly and uncontrollably. Yeah. Yeah, that's a fair point. Certainly, yeah, this is not my area of expertise, but I know some models, some population genetic models, in which the assumption is that they are growing more rapidly. But that may be a simplification. That may be a simplification.
Mm-hmm. Most of the cells in your body are neither growing nor dividing.
Right, right. Okay, so let's see. It's 1:15. On my schedule, it says I'm supposed to go until close to 1:30, but what is that? Is that what people are expecting? I honestly have never. No. Okay, I should wrap it up.
Yeah.
That's fine. So I've given you an overview of the way drugs and drug resistance evolution happens in these diverse systems. You can do some math on using this sort of framework to think about, well, how often do mutations happen? Say, for example, Richard works in HIV, and you can show that in a typical patient, the number in every viral reproduction event, in every generation, viral generation, every single point mutant in the genome is present, and many of the double point mutants are present. I should say that this algebra here presumes that mutations are beneficial regardless of what background they've appeared in. This is actually the area that I'm most interested in these days, is exceptions to that rule. When do mutations interfere with each other? When don't they work too well in combination? We can imagine that if we can just hit the infection or the cancer hard enough with drugs, then we can eradicate the population and the patient will survive and be healthy. And that's sort of been the protocol since the deployment of penicillin. But more recently, and Bob Gatenby, who'll be here later in our program, has made important contributions here to the idea of adaptive therapy that says, look, you can't ever beat this thing, and by deploying the drugs, you're selecting for drug resistance, which is, after all, a terminal failure. So Bob suggested therapy programs where you apply the drug in order to control the illness, and you think of it more as a chronic disease, and then let the situation sort of relax until there are clinical indications again. All right, at the very end here, what I want to do is just sort of highlight a few of the opportunities that have brought us together, this is a very idiosyncratic list. Experimentally, I'm really excited by opportunities that are made available by whole genome sequencing. So this is, of course, a wonderful technology, and the question is, where do we deploy it? But there were some really nice results recently. So, for example, there was an outbreak of a drug-resistant strain of Klebsiella in an NIH hospital recently. It looked like they were a bunch of independent origins because they were spread out in time over the course of 6 months, but when you did the genome sequencing, you realized that they were all descended from each other, and that completely changes the way you think about the epidemiology of what's going on inside the hospital. Really nice study done by our colleague Roy Cascione at Harvard with students of his, in which they were able to identify, by looking at multiple evolutionary from the hospital, finding multiple resistance events, able to identify the causal mutations. So that's really rich stuff. But the challenge is to know how to deploy the technology and how to collect data that's informative. As I told you, for example, whole genome sequencing of single cells in cancer is possible, but there are a lot of cells in a tumor. It's very hard to know which ones to sequence and what to make of them. There's also really interesting technology that we've heard a little bit about already in our program that has to do with looking at single cell behaviors. So everything I've said here and the sort of the typical thinking assumes that we're sort of in the regime of mass action, but there's a lot of heterogeneity in cell behavior, and there are now technologies that let us characterize that heterogeneity and think about implications for drug resistance evolution. On the theory side, there are also some really exciting, one other shout out I want to give to Sasha Levy, who's here, he and others have introduced technology that allow us to follow this process explicitly. You can grow populations of pathogens or of microbes that are labeled with unique little pieces of DNA called barcodes. They're what they sound like. And you can very quickly and economically measure the frequency of all these types over time and get a handle on the empirical facts of what those Mueller plots are doing. On the theory side, as I said, there have been some real advances in understanding that process. We have opportunities to think about novel deployment of antibiotics. I mentioned this adaptive therapy idea. Celia Schieffer, who will be here a little bit later, works on drug design with an eye toward designing drugs that are resistant. She thinks about the structural biology of these compounds, and they all bind into some pocket, and the idea is to make them bind in a way that's no larger or different from the native substrate, so that there simply are no mutations that can distinguish between the drug and its native substrate. Finally, there's a lot of effort coming back to the whole genome sequencing opportunity to do so-called personalized medicine, where you go to the doctor and they sequence your whole genome to figure out whether there are some particular opportunities given your biology to make advances. This, again, it's easy to talk about doing the sequencing, and it's not even that hard to do the sequencing, but to connect mutations that you find from those data with the actual biology that's causal in the illness or in the resistance story is of course, a huge challenge. Okay. Well, again, thank you very much for the opportunity to talk to you this afternoon. I'm really excited to be here, and I'd love to have questions. Many of my colleagues are here in the room as well. Thank you. I didn't get the. So the question was, is it reasonable to consider the possibility of genetically engineering patients? Right. And then what was the very last piece of your question?
Before this resistant
bacteria kills. Right. I don't know the answer. Certainly there were people talking about that. I'm hesitant to respond to the word reasonable. But that's certainly things that people are talking about. Right. And you could even imagine jiggering other parts of the host's biology. Do you mean engineering the host or engineering the pathogen? Yeah, so you could imagine, what I'm familiar with are people who have the idea of jiggering the host's biology in a way that they could be protected from some of these pathogens. Yeah. Yes?
So how will the cancer benefit from killing its host? Because once the patient dies, the cancer disappears as well.
Yeah, so the question is, why is it in a single cell's interest to propagate uncontrollably if it has the potential of killing the host, in particular of killing the host before the host reproduces? Yeah? Yeah, so the answer is, well, it's not, but as I said, evolution is a very short-sighted process. So imagine the following circumstance. Arbitrary liver example. I'm a liver cell, and my replication is being blocked by some fairly complicated genetic program that all liver cells observe. But in this cell, a mutation occurs that causes this cell to become insensitive to that regulatory control. So this cell will now reproduce and disregard the signals from cells around it that are telling it to stop. Now, at the level of that cell, Darwin says that's a beneficial mutation. And yes, it causes the host to, it may cause the host to keel over. It's analogous to the example I gave where an infection in one patient has a strong incentive to replicate more quickly within that patient, even though it may cause the net transmission into the subsequent hosts to be reduced. But on the short term, there's still an advantage.
Short term,
And the short term, there's still an advantage. But the point you're raising, that there are long-term costs, are the indirect fulcrum that drive these so-called indirect second-order selective effects that we presume are responsible for the evolution of tumor suppressors in longer-lived organisms like us. So there is an opportunity for that effect that you're thinking about to bear, but it's an indirect. It takes longer for that process to work. Yeah?
So if you look at the function of the likelihood of recurrence of cancer as a function of the age of the organism,
yep.
Probably lots of data like
that. Yep, absolutely. Yep.
Are there similar data for the short-lived organisms? And if so, do the functional forms look pretty similar?
That's a really interesting question. I just read, in preparing this talk, I read a really nice paper that takes those kinds of epidemiological data and then takes a model that's comparable to this that talks about what's the mutation. So let's think about this healthy liver tissue, this healthy liver cell, and there are some number of mutations required to cause it to break out of this social contract, and there's a mutation rate, and there are a number of cells in which these mutations can appear. So can you predict these epidemiological curves for the age of onset, or the probability of onset as a function of age, given these sort of first principled considerations? And the answer is yes, in the case of colon cancer, which is particularly well known. But I think it's a really great idea, because there is a community of biologists that appreciate that you can learn things from short-lived organisms about the way cancer works in long-lived organisms. It would be really interesting to make an analogous study. I went to a meeting last year on the evolution of cancer, and a guy who studies mole rats, which are really long-lived animals, said he's never broken through at the National Cancer Institute, even though that's his motivation, but the National Institute of Aging loves his work. So you have to sort of put things together as best you can. But the short answer is that's a marvelous question. Michael.
I wonder how much this paradox of the link between longevity and tumor suppression is really a paradox. Maybe these species wouldn't be long-lived if they hadn't solved that problem.
Well, that's a fair question. Yeah, so Michael's suggestion is it possible that organisms that entered into, let's say, a long-lived niche, right? We think a lot of evolutionary biologists think about new opportunities that were made available to organisms as a consequence of events. So Michael's suggestion is it possible that the suppression of tumor precedes the evolution of longevity? I don't actually quite know how to answer that question, and I don't think it materially affects the way we think about that tension, but it's a nice idea, something to think about. Yes, Greg.
You mentioned the discovery of the vancomycin resistance.
Yes.
Cassette in the ice cores.
Yes.
30,000 years ago.
Yeah.
I'm not sure you explained how it is that those bacteria had that cassette if, in fact, there were no.
Yes.
Right.
So Greg's question is, why in the world would you? How can you understand the appearance or the existence of antibiotic resistance in bacteria that are, as old as, older than the Bronze Age or something? And the answer is very interesting, and we don't have anything approaching a clear understanding, but most antibacterial compounds are naturally produced or derivatives of naturally produced compounds. So soil bacteria, particularly in the, I forget what organizational level, something higher than genus, so the streptomycetes, are really well known for producing these small molecules. And so pharmaceuticals have been mining them for years, and I have a chemist colleague, this is what he does for a living, is study how vancomycin, how streptomycetes make these compounds so he can do it in the lab. So microbes have been making these small compounds since the beginning, but for what purpose, no one knows. So is it signaling? I mean, the concentrations of these things in the soil and the ocean are unlikely to be what we would describe as clinical, but there are all kinds of signaling compounds that are well understood, or reasonably well understood, we think well understood among microbes, that have to do with things like identifying the density of conspecifics in a local patch. And this may be sort of, may have been once in that sort of repertoire. All right. Thank you so much.